CEO and founder of TrackMaven, Alan Gannett, believes that we have been spoon-fed the notion that creativity is the province of genius, of those favored brilliant few whose moments of insight arrived in unpredictable flashes of divine inspiration. And if we're not a genius, we might as well pack it in and give up. Either we have that gift or we don't. But according to our next guest, that simply isn't true. In his new book, The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time, big data entrepreneur Alan Gannett, a Forbes and Inc. 30 Under 30 awardee, tells us why and shows us how to get it. Again, the name of the book is The Creative Curve, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Alan Gannett to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, man.
Okay, so let us begin definitionally, and we'll start with what is the creative curve?
So the creative curve is my sort of more approachable name for a phenomenon that scientists have found where there's this inverse U-shaped relationship between familiarity and preference, where the more we see something, the more we like it, but only up until a point. And then we start actually getting bored of it, and we like it less and less each additional time we see it. And this is a really well-replicated finding in science, and it actually drives a lot of consumer preference and taste, but it's something we don't talk about enough. And so the creative curve is my attempt to make it a lot more approachable and easy to digest.
All right. So where is a good place to start when it comes to this?
So I think the thing that most people get wrong when they think about creativity, and the book is split up into two halves. The first half is most people think that creativity is this like mystical, wonderful, divine thing that a few people have and everyone else doesn't. And the issue is that this theory of creativity, this inspiration theory, is not supported by science at all. In fact, there's lots of science that shows us that everyone has the same creative potential, and it's how we nurture that potential that actually gets us to these great creative achievements. And so, you know, you can think about back when you were five, you were finger painting just like the rest of them, but by the time you were 25, chances are you probably gave up on your creative dreams. And we're sort of conditioned as a culture, and I hate to say, you know, the word fake news, but there's a little bit of fake news that goes on where we have these images of Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and all these people as these solo singular geniuses that are sort of mystically creating the stuff. And the problem is that when you actually dive in, that's not actually how it works. In fact, most of these creatives are really the story of a lot of hard and thoughtful work, not just hard work, but hard and thoughtful work.
So why are we squashing all this creativity?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons. I think one, there's an element of safety, right? So if you're a parent, there's generally in the United States, we have these sort of cultural norms around become a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, you know, be a professional. Those are very secure jobs. The other thing is that I actually think for many people, there's sort of an excuse that happens. They think that, well, for certain people, creativity is so easy, but it's not easy for me. So why should I even try? Why should I put the effort into actually getting better? And the problem with that logic is that when you actually go back in time and you actually look at the origins of a lot of these creative geniuses, and I explained a bunch of these examples in the book, they're actually not the stories of someone popping out of the womb with all this creative talent. Usually there's a story of someone starting that hard work very, very early. So by the time they're 18 or 20, we're like, wow, they're so young and talented, but they maybe already been practicing for 20 years. You know, Mozart started practicing the piano when he was 3 years old. Literally 3 years old. And so, of course, we don't see the struggle because the struggle happened so long ago. And we give ourselves sort of permission not to try because we think it's easy for someone else. And we make that sort of cognitive mistake, that cognitive error.
You address this in the book about creative communities, of how building a community around oneself is very important if you're going to nurture that creativity.
Yeah, so one of the fascinating things is there's actually a really amazing academic definition of creativity, and that definition is things that are both, the ability to create things that are both novel and valuable. Novel and valuable. They have to be both, right? If I throw a bunch of paint on a painting, it may be novel, but it's not valuable. If I, you know, recently I learned how to do conditional color formatting in Excel, that's valuable, but certainly not novel. And so since creativity is about doing things that are both novel and valuable, well, we have a problem. Because value is a social construct. We all have to agree that something is valuable for it to be valuable. And so since it's a social construct, you need to have lots of people involved in your creativity. So, you know, classically, you may think of like, you know, a teacher, someone who teaches you a certain craft, but actually one of the most important roles is that of a promoter. So you see in all creative fields, there's this sort of apprenticeship model where a more experienced, well-known, higher reputation creative figure lends their credibility to someone younger, earlier in their careers than them. You see this with professors taking on young researchers. You see this with musicians who have opening acts. You see this again and again and again. And that's actually one of the most important parts about creativity, because you need that exposure for people to see you, to then actually be able to have people assess whether or not this is valuable. And so the fact that creativity is this social construct actually makes it a very different thing than just going off into a cabin and, you know, writing your great American novel. In fact, there's this really fascinating study done by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, and he, when he was a graduate student, he did this study where he actually went and found art students, and then he followed them in their careers. And what he found was that in art school, the art students who performed the best were the ones who sort of fit the stereotype of the neurotic, dark, creative. But the ones that actually succeeded in their creative careers, they were actually none of those students. It was the students who were the best at salesmanship, the best at PR, the best at marketing, the ones who could actually get their ideas out there and actually get people to actually look at them and assess them and judge whether or not they're valuable.
One of the stories you tell in the book is about the creators of the Tony Award-winning show Dear Evan Hansen. Tell us a little bit about their story and why that is relevant when it comes to the creative curve.
Yeah, so one of the things that I thought was really interesting when you dive into creativity and you write a book on creativity is you often get a bunch of scenarios around collaboration. And collaboration happens in many different ways. You know, I would say if you think about a J.K. Rowling type figure, you know, she doesn't have a co-author, but she has editors and marketing people and proofreaders and all sorts of people who are helping her and getting her creative product out there. But you also have people who have much more direct collaboration. And so Pasek and Paul is this songwriting duo, Justin Paul and Benj Pasek, who've had a pretty good run the last few years. They did the music for La La Land. They did Dear Evan Hansen. They did the music for The Greatest Showman. Like, you know, pretty good. And I interviewed them, and what I thought was so interesting was that oftentimes when we think about collaborators or co-founders of a business, you know, you want people who you gel with, you get along with, but actually, they're incredibly different. So Benj Pasek, for example, is this sort of like exuberant. I was talking to him on the phone, and I could hear him sort of bouncing up and down, and he's just very excitable, very high energy. Justin Paul is this very thoughtful, very down to earth, very logical thinking, kind of quiet guy. And what's interesting is both of them realize that by themselves, they probably wouldn't be as successful because, you know, Benj's issue is, well, how do you actually take all these ideas he's constantly stewing about and actually turn them into a finished song? And Justin's thing is he has the system and the process and the logic, but where are the ideas going to come from? And so these two are actually so different, but actually the fact that they're finding collaborators who help their weaknesses, not their strengths, but help their weaknesses. And this is one of the big mistakes I see with creatives is that they think, oh, well, you know, I can't be a great writer, singer, entrepreneur, or whatever it is, because I'm not good at X. But the creatives that I interviewed for the book, what they did is they actually found people to fill those gaps for them. They found what I call conflicting collaborators.
So that takes a lot of introspection and understanding of yourself to realize that's necessary.
100%. I mean, this is definitely, if you want to be creative, a therapist is probably a good investment.
Well, there you go. Right. Because seeing that in yourself, I mean, another way of asking the question is, how much of it is just dumb luck then?
Yeah, I think it's not. I think there are a lot of people who luck their way into being at the right place at the right time, right? You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there's this effect that sociologists call clustering, where you see people in similar creative fields move into neighborhoods very close to each other, right? You see in San Francisco, everyone moves to the SoMa neighborhood, where now there's the headquarters for, you know, Zynga, Twitter, your Salesforce Tower is just down the street. You know, obviously you see in New York, there's fashion areas, art areas, you see all the sort of people who move to Brooklyn. And so you see this effect of clustering. And some people are born into that, right? Some people, you know, grew up their whole lives in LA, and so getting into entertainment and getting into the arts is very straightforward. So that is, you could say in one way, luck. But for the rest of us, there's a lot of intentionality you can have, right? If you want to, you know, get into entertainment, you better move to LA. You know, the internet has sort of democratized and flattened a lot of the world, but there's still a huge effect of creativity since people are so important to it, to actually be able to see people face to face and actually be able to have those random run-ins on the sidewalk or, you know, get that, you know, coffee together and actually spend that time. And so moving to the place where your field is most concentrated is an intentional thing you can do to actually get better.
When it comes to the obstacles, how long should you give yourself to get around them? In the sense of, there is no such thing as giving up, but when do you give up?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think one of the mistakes that people have is how they attempt to get better at things. So there's this sort of common misnomer in a lot of stuff around talent development, skill development, especially in the popular press, around this idea of the 10,000 hours principle, which is this idea that was popularized by Malcolm Gladwell. It says, you know, if you practice anything for 10,000 hours, you'll get great. You'll be world class. The problem is that's not actually what the science says. So that idea was based off the research by K. Anders Ericsson, who's a professor who does a lot of amazing work on talent development. And the issue is that, and Anders Ericsson, I interviewed for my book, and he gave me this quote that I put in the book that says, you know, Malcolm misread my paper, period. And the thing that he got wrong is that it's not that he's saying that's 10,000 hours of practice. The paper makes very clear it's not practice. It's 10,000 hours of purposeful practice. And those are two very different things. Purposeful practice is a very specific term. It means practice where you take a big skill and you break it down to very, very tiny little things. So if you're a basketball player, it's the difference between saying, well, let's just keep playing basketball versus saying, let me practice my left-handed dribble down the midcourt. Or another example I'd say is, you know, any suburban driver's probably driven 10,000 hours in their life, but they're not a NASCAR driver. But if you wanted to become a NASCAR driver, you'd focus on very small skills. Well, how do I start really effectively? How do I make a sharp turn where I'm going really fast? And so by breaking down skills into very, very small functional elements, what you're able to do is really get better at this thing in a non-automatic way. Where instead of letting your subconscious take over, you can really think about it. You can see, how do I get better at this one little thing? So that's the first thing he got wrong. The second thing he got wrong is that it wasn't 10,000 hours of practice. It was 10,000 hours on average across people, across skills. So some skills, like playing the piano these days, takes about 25,000 hours to become world class because so many people have done it before. Versus other things like, for example, digit memorization, which is now an actual thing they have competitions around, takes about 400 hours to become world class. And different people will have some different variation from there too. And so one of the problems we have is I think that we do something, but we're not actually doing it in the right way. We're not doing purposeful practice. We're just practicing. We're just playing basketball over and over and over again. But if you looked at Kobe Bryant or you looked at Michael Jordan or any of these players, and you look at their training regimen, it's all these small skills. And that's the same thing you need to do when it comes to creative skills and creative functions.
When you are all, when it is all said and done, what do you hope people get out of the book?
You know, for the book, I interviewed 25 living creative geniuses. These are billionaires, startup moguls, artists, painters, all these different types of people. And the thing that I took away from all these meetings, these are people who are super successful, you know, at the top of their games, is that for all of them, there was a rationality behind what they were doing. There was a system. There was a thought process. There's a way that they think about getting better. And I want people, when they read the book, to take this home, that you can achieve great creative things in your lifetime. But I'm not saying it's easy. I think that's one of the things you worry about when you write a book that lays out a system, is that people might say, well, there's a system, so it's easy. I'm not saying it's easy. I actually think it's incredibly hard. I just think there are steps you can do, and that should be freeing, and that should be motivating, because if you decide to actually put your time and effort into that, you can achieve a lot.
The name of the book is The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Alan, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks, man.
Again, the name of the book is The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Alan Gannett is the author. The book is published by Penguin Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.